Brother Tom said, we've been teaching through the book of Joshua for several months now, actually almost a year, because we started before the pandemic hit last year and had to take a little break while we were not meeting regularly. And it's been, you know, a blessing to me to do this study, and hopefully a blessing to our adult Sunday school class. And we're coming to the end of this this book, this historical record of the children of Israel under the leadership of Joshua and their conquest of the promised land that God had given them. And so last week we came to this text, which just reading through the book, it's a little bit, you know, kind of out of place in my mind anyway, and maybe to others, but it certainly was not out of place in God's timing of my needing to study this, and hopefully for us to hear, and even for those of you who are hearing it for the second time, to hear it again, because I certainly needed to study it again, and for the Lord to speak to us through His Word about what we can learn. And what we've been doing in our adult Sunday school class is the kind of the overall intent of our study is to learn lessons for us as new covenant believers, those who have been brought into God's kingdom, brought into and gathered here, particularly here at Ala Grove, and how we can learn from this old covenant record, this historical record of the children of Israel, God's people, as they entered into and settled in the promised land. And this morning, we're going to learn lessons for new covenant believers in dealing with sin among God's people. And you'll see that there, when I say dealing with sin, in this case, we'll see that it was apparent sin, but still lessons for us to learn nonetheless. For a couple of different reasons. First off, I'm still having trouble reading this small print. I might have to go up on my strength of my glasses here, but I'm going to read from using my phone, because I want to use the ESV to read from this morning. And before we get into Joshua 22, just because we have a lot in here who have not been part of this study, we need to do a little quick background. So if you'll back up to Joshua 21 and verse 43, if you're turned there in your Bibles. Let's read those three verses there at the end of Joshua 21. Thus Yahweh gave to Israel all the land that he swore to give to their fathers, and they took possession of it, and they settled there. And the Lord gave them rest on every side, just as he had sworn to their fathers. Not one of all their enemies had withstood them, for the Lord had given all their enemies into their hands. Not one word of all the good promises that the Lord had made to the house of Israel had failed. All came to pass. So here at the end of Joshua 21, we have a summary of what has happened for the children of Israel in their conquest of the promised land. Yahweh had given them all the land he had promised, at least in the sense that they occupied and controlled all the land of Canaan, although we know from the preceding chapters, again, if you had been in our study, you would know that a little clearer maybe, but even knowing from what happens in the book of Judges that the children of Israel failed to completely drive out the Canaanites, as God had commanded them to do. Yet at this point in their history, they at least controlled and were settled in the entire land of Canaan that God had promised them. The record goes on to say that Yahweh had fulfilled all of the good promises to his people, including the fact that he had given them rest from all their enemies. It gets, at least in the sense that there was no open war with the Canaanites. Even though, again, there were some who were allowed to remain in the land of Canaan, contrary to God's commandment to them, they were at peace, they were at rest, in the sense that they at least controlled the land and had control over those Canaanites who remained in the land. There was no open war. That is the sense of the rest that God had given them from their enemies. Although it's not explicitly stated here, the fulfillment of these promises, all these good promises, and this rest that God gave them, including the dividing of the land as an inheritance for the tribes of Israel. That is a critical part of the book of Joshua. Joshua, who most likely wrote this record, spends several chapters just describing in detail the dividing of the land among the tribes of Israel. The bounds, a very detailed description of the geography and topography of the land that was divided. So that's part of this summary here, even though it's not explicitly stated, is part of this fulfillment of God's promises, fulfillment of the rest that he gave them. Well, at least that is true of the nine and a half tribes of the tribes of Israel, that they were had now been settled and divided and had been given inheritance in the land and were settled for the most part in that land. As we'll see from the opening section of chapter 22 that we're going to read here in a minute, there was a group of Israelites who were not yet fully established in their inherited land and therefore not fully at rest along with their Israelite brothers and sisters. In order to fully understand what is happening here in chapter 22 that we're going to look at here in a moment, we must briefly examine a couple of texts earlier in the book of Joshua. We won't turn there for the sake of time, but if you'll just listen as I read these texts. First, in Joshua 13:7, we read this command of the Lord to Joshua. Now, therefore, portion or divide this land, speaking of the land of Canaan, for an inheritance to the nine tribes and the half tribe of Manasseh. So there, the Lord telling Joshua to divide the land of Canaan, the land of promise, among the nine and a half tribes of Israel. Why only nine and a half tribes? Well, the next verse tells us, Joshua 13:8 says, with the other half tribe of Manasseh, the Reubenites and the Gadites received their inheritance, which Moses gave them beyond the Jordan to the east, just as Moses, the servant of the Lord, gave to them. Back in the book of Deuteronomy, it's recorded that two and a half tribes, the tribe of Reuben, the tribe of Gad, and half the tribe of Manasseh, had already been given their land inheritance by Moses on the east side of Jordan. Joshua 4, verses 12 and 13 provides the additional background for what we will see in the first part of Joshua 22. Recorded there is this description of the sons of Reuben and the sons of Gad and the half-tribe of Manasseh crossed over in battle away before the sons of Israel, just as Moses had spoken to them. About 40,000 equipped for war crossed for battle before the Lord to the desert plains of Jericho. So what we have recorded there is a description of the soldiers, 40,000 in number, around 40,000 in number, of the tribes that were already settled, had already been given their land, were living in that land on the east side of the Jordan River. They still fulfilled their commitment, their promise that they made to the Lord through Moses, that they would still go in with the other tribes of Israel, the other nine and a half tribes, and fulfill the work of the Lord in conquering the land of Canaan. So now we come to our text. We're going to do something a little bit different this morning. Sometimes with historical narratives, and we always should strive to get the full context of God's Word, but sometimes with historical narratives, when we read the full context, we read ahead and we read things back into portions of the text. And with historical narratives, I think sometimes it's helpful for us to read it in sections so that we get the full understanding of where we're at that point in the story. It's kind of like watching a movie all the way through and then trying to go back and read back into what happens in the movie later on, back into what happens before, or reading a novel. In historical narratives in God's Word, we sometimes need to just see it as it unfolds. Again, always seeing it contextually, but maybe differently than we would see a doctrinal text where we want to see the full text, maybe a little, and then look into the details. So we're going to do something a little different. We're going to read the text in the sections, deal with it as it is revealed to us in the narrative, so that we can maybe have a little more clarity at what's happening at that point in the story. So let's start with the first section of chapter 22. Let's read those first nine verses of Joshua 22. At that time, Joshua summoned the Reubenites and the Gadites and the half-tribe of Manasseh and said to them, "You have kept all that Moses, the servant of the Lord, commanded you and have obeyed my voice and all that I have commanded you. You have not forsaken your brothers these many days down to this day, but have been careful to keep the charge of the Lord your God. And now the Lord your God has given rest to your brothers as he promised them. Therefore, turn and go to your tents in the land where your possession lies, which Moses, the servant of the Lord, gave you on the other side of Jordan. Only be careful to observe the commandment that the law and the law that Moses, the servant of the Lord, commanded you to love the Lord your God, and to walk in all his ways, and to keep his commandments, and to cling to him, and to serve him with all your heart and with all your soul. So Joshua blessed them and sent them away, and they went to their tents. Now to the one half of the tribe of Manasseh, Moses had given a possession in Bashan, but to the other half, Joshua had given possession beside their brothers in the land west of the Jordan. And when Joshua sent them away to their homes and blessed them, he said to them, go back to your tents with much wealth and with very much livestock, with silver, gold, bronze, and iron, and with much clothing. Divide the spoil of your enemies with your brothers. So the people of Reuben and the people of Gad, the half tribe of Manasseh, returned home, parting from the people of Israel at Shiloh, which is in the land of Canaan, to go to the land of Gilead, their own land, of which they had possessed themselves by the command of the Lord through Moses. So here in the first part of chapter 22, we have Joshua commending the soldiers from the tribes of Reuben, Gad, and half of Manasseh for a job well done, and then ultimately sending them home to their rest. Joshua tells them that in the time that they had been with him, what probably around 7 years, based on some calculations we can do about Joshua's age that's revealed in other places in the book of Joshua, around 7 years they had been part of this, the people of Israel who were, as they conquered the land of Canaan, helping the tribes west of the Jordan, the western tribes, to conquer their enemies. And he says that they had been completely obedient and helpful, completely obedient to what Moses had commanded them, which again included their fulfilling the commitment to fight alongside their Israelite brothers in the conquest of Canaan, and fully obedient in their obedience to him, Joshua. And when he says that, it's important to remember Joshua and Moses. Moses and Joshua were God's representatives. When he says that they obeyed Moses and Joshua, what he's really saying is they obeyed the Lord. Their obedience was to God himself. Again, they had gone out and fought on behalf of their brethren, even though they already had their own inheritance, even as God had commanded them to do. It could have been easy for them to enjoy what God had given them, stay in their land, stay with their families. God had already blessed them with that, but they fulfilled the commitment, the command that God had gave them to fight alongside their brothers and in the conquest of the land of Canaan. This faithfulness, this loyalty, and even the sacrifice they made to be away from their families. Some of them possibly even died. We know that there were some Israelites who died at the Battle of Ai. Whatever sacrifice they made, it would have garnered great trust, respect, and even affection, love from their fellow Israelites that almost certainly played a part in the events that we're going to see later in our text. Now that the land was conquered and fully distributed to the other tribes, they could go back to their families and lands on the eastern side of the Jordan and experience the same rest God had given to their Israelite brothers and sisters. Joshua follows this commendation of them with a command. He tells them to take diligent heed to the word of God. He tells them to love the Lord, to love Yahweh. He tells them to obey God with all they have, to keep his commandments, to cling to him, to hold fast to him, and to serve him with all their heart and soul. This is a repeat of what we see back in Exodus and Leviticus, this description of the loving Lord your God with all your heart, soul, and mind. Joshua rephrases it a bit, but it has the same general sense of commitment to the Lord, that even though they were no longer needed to be part of the battle, the war of conquest in the land of Canaan, that didn't fulfill their responsibility to continue serving the Lord. One of the things we stressed is that even as they found rest, whether it be the western tribes that's described back at the end of Joshua 21, or now these eastern tribes that were returning to their homes, this rest didn't mean they were just supposed to sit back and take it easy. That's not at all what it means by rest. It means that they were to continue to serve the Lord, continue to fulfill his word, continue to cling to him, desire to serve him. And this is, the order here is important. First, we should take care to hear God in his word. Then we give him our love. Next comes a walk of obedience. And to get that out of order, which we sometimes do, sometimes we love without hearing, which can lead us into heresy, or sometimes we obey before we love, which can lead us into legalism. Those are all dangers. So Joshua's very specific in the order that he gives as he commands them and to continue to serve the Lord, to love Him, to follow Him as they return their homes. Joshua concludes his message to these men from these 2.5 tribes with a blessing or consecration. So he's given them a commendation, a command, and now a consecration. He knows that they cannot do what he commanded them to do, or ultimately what the Lord has commanded them to do through Joshua, without God's blessing on their lives. It's very possible that he used the blessing from Numbers 6, 23 through 27. In fact, that blessing was specifically said to be when the children of Israel would give one another a blessing, they were to use Numbers chapter 6. And this text should be familiar to us because it was shared with us by our pastor as a blessing to us on New Year's Day. And it's Numbers 6, 23 through 27, where it says, "Speak to Aaron and his sons, saying, 'This is the way you shall bless the children of Israel. Say to them, the Lord bless you and keep you. The Lord make his face shine upon you and be gracious to you. The Lord lift up his countenance upon you and give you peace. So they shall put my name on the children of Israel, and I will bless them.'" It's very possible, very likely, that that is the blessing that Joshua pronounced upon, the consecration that he pronounced upon these people as they were returning back to their homes. Their obedience to God and faithfulness to their brethren had been rewarded. We see that at the end of that the section we read, where God had blessed them to gain much spoil, much plunder, that they could take back home with them to their families. We can believe that when we obey God, we will gain, not lose. Now, many times, most likely not always in this obvious material sense, but in real wonderful ways, God will bless us and give us gain because of our faithfulness to Him. These were true veterans of the Army of Israel, men who had served and fought for years in sacrifice, time away from their family, away from the land that they had been given. And they had been blessed for their service, and Joshua wants that blessing to continue as they return home. So he gives them this consecration and reminds them of the things that God had blessed them with already as they return to their home. The second thing we want to see is just found in one verse, verse 10. "And when they came to the region of the Jordan that is in the land of Canaan, the people of Reuben and the people of Gad and the half-tribe of Manasseh built there an altar by the Jordan, an altar of imposing size," a great altar as it may be described in other translations. So before returning home, these soldiers, these men from these 2.5 tribes, they stop and they construct a great impressive altar near the Jordan River. This altar was significant not only because of its size, because it was an altar and what an altar meant to these people, what it would have meant to them. An altar was primarily a place of sacrifice. And the Israelites and even the pagans that surrounded the Israelites, the Canaanites and others, had altars that they used for sacrifice. That was the primary purpose of an altar. Now at this point in the narrative, and that's why I think it's important for us not to get too much ahead and not read back what we may find out later in the text too much into what's happening now. At this point in the narrative, we don't know why they built this altar. We just know they built an altar. An altar of great size, of imposing size, as the ESV translates it. Was it a foreshadowing of the pagan altars that would later appear among the Jewish people? We know that throughout their history, the Jews struggled with building altars to other gods. Was it a foreshadowing of that? Was it an early example of that? Or was it a place of worship and sacrifice that they, at least in their minds, designed to serve as an alternative to the altar that God had prescribed to be placed at the tabernacle, which was currently located at Shiloh? Again, at this point in the narrative, we don't know. And neither does anyone who sees this construction, who sees this altar being built. All we know is that it was large enough for word to get back to the other tribes of its construction, leading to a confrontation between the eastern tribes and the western tribes. And that's what we'll see in verses 11 through 20 as we read there. Speaking of verse 11, it says, "And the people of Israel heard it said, 'Behold, the people of Reuben and the people of Gad and the half-tribe of Manasseh built the altar at the frontier of the land of Canaan in the region about the Jordan on the side that belongs to the people of Israel.' And when the people of Israel heard of it, the whole assembly of the people of Israel gathered in Shiloh to make war against them." Then the people of Israel sent to the people of Reuben and the people of Gad and the half-tribe of Manasseh in the land of Gilead, Phinehas, the son of Eleazar, the priest, and with him 10 chiefs, one from each of the tribal families of Israel, every one of them the head of a family among the clans of Israel. And they came to the people of Reuben, the people of Gad, and the half-tribe of Manasseh in the lands of Gilead, and they said to them, "Thus is the whole congregation of the Lord. What is the breach of faith that you have committed against the God of Israel and turning away this day from following the Lord by building yourselves an altar this day in rebellion against the Lord? Have we not had enough of the sin of Peor, from which even yet we have not cleansed ourselves, and for which there came a plague upon the congregation of the Lord, that you too must turn away this day from following the Lord? If you too rebel against the Lord today, then tomorrow he will be angry with the whole congregation of Israel. But now, if the land of your possession is unclean, pass over into the Lord's land where the Lord's tabernacle stands and take for yourselves a possession among us. Only do not rebel against the Lord or make us as rebels by building for yourselves an altar other than the altar of the Lord our God. Did not Achan the son of Zerah break faith in the matter of the devoted things? And wrath fell upon all the congregation of Israel, and he did not perish alone for his iniquity." So when news of this altar, this impressive altar, this great altar of great size comes to the rest of Israel, there's a simple and almost instantaneous reaction. They gather to make war against their own brothers who constructed this altar. Now some use verses 11 and 12 to warn of the dangers of listening and responding to hearsay or gossip. I was amazed, although I shouldn't be, of the number of commentators and sermons I read that spent half of their time discussing this one little phrase that they heard that this altar was being built, and they use it as a way to address hearsay or gossip, or the danger of listening to hearsay or gossip. And if anyone knows me, that would be my tendency as well, to get on my soapbox and berate the dangers of hearsay or gossip, listening to hearsay or gossip. But I don't think that's what the primary purpose or intent of the text is. There are scriptures, many scriptures, that we could go to that provide ample warning against hearsay and gossip. And if that were the point of the text this morning, we would certainly address it, but I don't believe it is. It's sort of stated matter-of-factly. They heard that they had built this altar. Now, if they had immediately attacked based on simply what they had heard, then certainly we could use an example of how not to respond to hearsay or gossip. But at this point, all they did was prepare to go to war. Now, we could ask, why did they do this? Again, at this point in the narrative, we don't know their exact reason. We don't know their motive. Possibly they feared that this altar was a sign of allegiance to the pagan gods of the region. The eastern tribes were going to be somewhat isolated and separated from the rest of the Israelite community. So maybe the western tribes were concerned for these that they loved and respected, those that they had fought side by side with for around 7 years, that they were going to, in their isolation, in their separation on the other side of the Jordan River, away from the congregation of the people, away from the Israelite community, that maybe they were going to be more susceptible to go off into idolatry. And maybe that's their concern, that that's what they're already witnessing here in the building of this, the construction of this altar. We just don't know at this point in the narrative. We do find out later, and we'll address that in a moment, but at this point in the text, I think it's unfair to read into their motives and question that they're just responding too quickly to hearsay or gossip. Although, again, that's what some I've seen do. I don't think that is what is intended for us to learn from the text. What we can gather just from the record of Scripture, without reading into it, without getting on our own personal soapboxes, without going off on the tangents as we tend to do, as we all tend to do, as I know I tend to do, is they were ready to fight a battle against what they perceived as sin and rebellion against God. And they were ready, encouraged to confront that sin, to stand up for God's truth and holiness. They were willing and ready to act, but not to do so hastily. That is also important that we see that, and we'll see that even more clearly in a moment. This should be our attitude when dealing with apparent sin and disobedience. Have courage, be bold to stand for what is right, while being careful not to act rashly, not to act hastily, not to take, if it is gossip or hearsay, if we want to describe it that way, again, I'm not sure that that's exactly what's intended in the text, but if we want to describe it that way, taking that gossip or hearsay and using it to attack our brothers and sisters hastily is not the right way either. But it's also not enough just to stand back and let sin in our continue in our midst. They did not do either. They were prepared to stand against sin, to deal with sin, but they did not do so rashly or hastily. Before they do take action, before they do attack, before they wage war against their brothers and sisters, send a group of representatives led by Phinehas the high priest and represented from each of the tribes west of the Jordan to personally confront the leaders of the tribes east of the Jordan. Again, Phinehas led this group probably because he was the spiritual authority in Israel. He was the high priest of the whole nation, including these 2.5 tribes on the east side of the Jordan. And not only had authority, he also had the heart of a wise shepherd. We see that in previous situations, including the one that's mentioned here, specifically the situation at Peor. He was very critical to the resolution of that. So he had the heart of a wise shepherd, and he wanted to, along with these other representatives, correct the erring, to protect the nation, and to drive out the dangerous. Israel, at least, again, all we know at this point in the narrative is they were reacting according to God's character. They assembled for war in demonstration of God's holiness, desire to deal with sin, even perceived sin, even apparent sin. But then their personal confrontation, their willingness to go and personally confront what they believed to be erring brothers and sisters, demonstrated God's love. Now here we do, as we just read, we do learn why Phinehas and the rest of the people of Israel were ready to go to war. They thought that the altar of the Jordan that was built on the Jordan River was an altar, or was going to be a rival place of sacrifice and worship. And that was a legitimate concern. They thought this was going to be a place to compete with God's tabernacle that was presently located at Shiloh. God had clearly commanded multiple times in the law that there was one place of sacrifice of burnt offerings for Israel. Leviticus 17:8-9 records it this way: "Also you shall say to them, whatever man of the house of Israel or of the strangers who dwell among you who offers a burnt offering or sacrifice and does not bring it to the door of the tabernacle of meeting to offer it to the Lord, that man shall be cut off from among his people." So this was no minor thing. This was no trivial thing to build an altar that was, and again, at least in their mind at this point in the narrative, was a violation of this very clear and direct command to not build a rival place of sacrifice and worship. This is an example of how we cannot worship any way we please or justify a manner of worship just because we like it. We must do what is pleasing to God in our worship. We must worship Him in spirit and in truth, as Jesus told the woman at the well in John 4:24. So they come to them with this, confronting them with what they believe to be an error, a sin, a rebellion on the part of these eastern tribes in building this altar that they thought was a direct rebellion against the command of God of having an alternative place of sacrifice than what God had commanded. In this confrontation, they remind the eastern tribes that Israel had been punished for rebellion against God before. And they use the rebellion at Peor as an example. There at Peor, Israel's men committed adultery with Moabite women, and they gave themselves over to the worship of the Moabite gods. And in judgment, God sent a plague that killed 24,000 people. And again, this incident would have been especially meaningful to Phinehas, as he was the one who stopped the plague by making a dramatic stand for righteousness in the midst of that gross sin. So Phinehas, along with these others, particularly Phinehas, knew that the sin of these tribes would reflect on the whole nation. He knew that no one really sins into himself, and even later uses a second example of the price of sin. He uses the example later on in this confrontation, the example of the wickedness of Achan and how it affected all of Israel at the Battle of Ai. So they confront this sin, what they believe to be apparent sin, this rival altar, in direct disobedience to God's command to have a single place of sacrifice at the tabernacle. They use two examples of previous rebellions that resulted in God's judgment against the children of Israel, not just those who were involved in the rebellion or the disobedience, but the entire nation being affected by it. So they're concerned about what they believe to be sin, and they're confronting it. There's a couple things, though, we need to point out about this confrontation. First off, even though Phinehas and the other representatives of the western tribes had personally witnessed and been affected by the sin of others at Peor and Ai, and would have been affected by any disobedience on the part of the eastern tribes, as they describe here, their focus was not primarily personal. Look again at what was said and even repeated in verses 16 through 19. Let's read those words again. Thus says the whole congregation of the Lord. So they're saying we're speaking on behalf of the rest of the community, the congregation of God's people, of Israel. What is this breach of faith that you've committed? Some translations, treachery is how it's translated. This breach of faith, this violation of God's command that you've committed against the God of Israel, that you've committed against the God of Israel, in turning away this day from following Yahweh, by building yourselves an altar this day in rebellion against Yahweh. And then they use the example of Peor. Then they come back to 18, that you must turn away this day from following Yahweh. And if you too rebel against Yahweh today, then tomorrow he will be angry with the whole congregation. So they continue to emphasize, whoever speaking, probably Phinehas, but we don't know for sure, but whoever speaking on behalf of this group that's come to confront the eastern tribes, they continue to emphasize that this rebellion or apparent sin that they perceive on the part of their brothers and sisters is rebellion against God, sin against God. They don't make it primarily personal. They do bring out the fact that it would affect all of God's people, but that is not their primary emphasis. While we are certainly affected by the sin of others within our community, and we can apply it to the church, while we are certainly affected personally by the sin of fellow church members and may be personally offended by that sin, our focus when we lovingly confront that sin should be on the offense against God and His glory. If our focus is primarily personal, which we have a tendency to do, it will most likely be perceived as legalistic and self-righteous. Another thing that's important here, something that we don't want to miss, despite their concern for God's holiness, and again, at this point in the narrative and what we can read, that's all we can say is they have a zeal and concern for God's holiness and want to confront that among their others of their community. They don't just tell the builders of the altar they're a bunch of sinners and they go on the attack. They do tell them that they are, if they are doing what they think they're doing, they are in violation of God's command. They are rebelling against God, but they don't just call them a bunch of sinners and go on the attack. And we may not see that at first when we first read this, but it is here. Read again in verse 19. But now if the land of your possession is unclean, pass over into the Lord's land where the Lord's tabernacle stands and take for yourself a possession among us. Only do not rebel against the Lord to make us as rebels by building for ourselves an altar other than the altar of the Lord our God. Again, we may just, if we don't really understand the context and the history here, we may just say that, well, they just want them to come back and live with them so they can keep an eye on them, so they can, you know, police them, so they can watch over them. And there probably is a sense of accountability to some extent, but it's really, really much more than that. As I mentioned earlier, there's a strong, tremendous emphasis throughout the book of Joshua, particularly the middle section, of the dividing of the land as inheritance to the tribes of Israel. And there's very specific instruction multiple times over and over again about dividing the land based on the size of the tribes, and in order to make sure that there was ample resources to meet the needs of the people of that tribe. The larger the tribe, the more land they got, because they needed more land to grow food, to raise livestock. So think about that for a moment. What would it mean for the 9.5 tribes on the western side of the Jordan River to allow the rest of the people of the 2.5 tribes? We don't know how many thousands, hundreds of thousands, millions of people might have been as part of those eastern tribes. Whatever that would have meant to them, to allow them to come and live in the land that they had been given for inheritance. It would mean they would have to give up some of their resources, some of their land, some of the inheritance that God had blessed them with. It would require them to sacrifice. They were willing to sacrifice to keep their fellow Israelites from sin. If there was something unclean in the land that they were possessing, that Moses, by the command of God, had given them on the eastern side of Jordan, here the other tribes were inviting them to come and live with them in the land on the western side of the Jordan. And again, this was an invitation made at great cost. They were going to have to sacrifice part of what God had given them. But it didn't matter because they were willing to sacrifice to see their brothers free from sin. This is an example of what Paul describes as serving one another, or literally becoming slave to one another in Galatians 5:13, and bearing one another's burdens in Galatians 6:2. Helping others in our community, and again, let's make application to our church community, to deal with sin requires us to be willing to serve and sacrifice. It's not enough just to confront sin and call out sin and attack others for sin. It requires truly dealing with sin within the community of God's people. Requires us to do what these Israelites on the western side of Jordan were willing to do: give up their land, sacrifice, in order to help their brothers deal with sin. Sadly, too many of us lack this willingness. We tell people to stop sinning, but are not willing to help them if it costs us something. In the last section of the text, we've seen this confrontation. Now we're going to see a conversation, or at least a two-way conversation. Again, many times confronting sin ends up being a one-way conversation. Thankfully, this did not end that way. Let's pick up at verse 21. Then the people of Reuben, the people of Gad, and the half-tribe of Manasseh said in answer to the heads of the families of Israel, "The Mighty One, God, the Lord, the Mighty One, God, the Lord." So they repeat this this name of God. It's literally El Elohim, Yahweh, is the literal what's being said there. So it's the three names of God repeated twice. "He knows, and let Israel itself know. If it was in rebellion or in the breach of faith against the Lord, do not spare us today." If we had done what you accused us of doing, or confronting us of doing, then we deserve to be judged. We deserve to be judged by God, specifically, for building an altar to turn away from following the Lord. "Or if we did so to offer burnt offerings or grain offerings or peace offerings on it, may the Lord himself take vengeance. No, but we did it from fear that in time to come your children might say to our children, 'What have you to do with the Lord, the God of Israel? For the Lord has made the Jordan a boundary between us and you, you people of Reuben and people of Gad. You have no portion in the Lord, so your children might make our children cease to worship the Lord.' Therefore we said, 'Let's now build an altar not for burnt offering nor for sacrifice, but to be a witness between us and you, and between our generation after us, that we do perform the service of the Lord in his presence with our burnt offering and sacrifices and peace offerings. So your children will not say to our children in the time to come, you have no portion in the Lord.'" What they're saying there is, this was a memorial to say, actually, we are going to participate in the sacrifices. Even though we're on the other side of the Jordan, it may seem like we're isolated. We're going to participate in the sacrifices that are going to occur in the presence of the Lord. And what that means is at the tabernacle where the Lord's presence dwelt on the mercy seat of the Ark of the Covenant. That's what's meant when they said, that they're going to participate in those sacrifices that the Lord prescribed to be done in the right place at the right time. "And we thought, continuing, this should be said to us, our descendants, in time to come. We should say, 'Behold, the copy of the altar of the Lord, which our fathers made, not for burnt offerings, nor for sacrifice, but be a witness between us and you. Far be it from us that we should rebel against the Lord and turn away this day from following the Lord by building an altar for burnt offering, grain offering, or sacrifice, other than the altar of the Lord our God that stands before his tabernacle.' When Phinehas the priest and the chiefs of the congregation, the heads of the families of Israel who were with him, heard the words that the people of Reuben and the people of Gad and the people of Manasseh spoke, it was good in their eyes. And Phinehas the son of Eleazar the priest said to the people of Reuben and the people of Gad and the people of Manasseh, 'Today we know that the Lord is in our midst, because you have not committed this breach of faith, this treachery against the Lord. Now you have delivered the people of Israel from the hand of the Lord.' Then Phinehas the son of Eleazar the priest and the chiefs returned from the people of Gad and the people people of Reuben and the people of Gad and the land of Gilead to the land of Canaan to the people of Israel and brought back word to them. And the report was good in the eyes of the people of Israel. And the people of Israel blessed God and spoke no more of making war against them to destroy the land where the people of Reuben and the people of Gad were settled. The people of Reuben and the people of Gad called the altar witness. For they said, it is a witness between us that Yahweh is God. Before we look at what was said here, real quickly, I want us to briefly think about what was not said. Put yourselves in the place of those of the tribe of Reuben and Gad, and half the tribe of Manasseh, these eastern tribes, and think about how it would feel to be confronted for what we now know to be just perceived sin, not a misunderstanding. A misunderstanding of what was happening there when that altar was constructed. Our tendency would be, I know my tendency would be to, before I even two words got out of Phinehas' mouth or whoever spoke, especially when he said, referred to what I did or didn't do, what they thought I did as treachery or a breach of faith against God, what would have been our response? We would have, I won't say what anybody else would have done. I would have immediately defended myself. How dare you accuse me of doing something I didn't do? We haven't done anything wrong. Wouldn't that have been our tendency? Again, I won't speak for you. I know that would have been my tendency to defend myself, right? Not even give them a chance to finish talking, but that didn't happen. They allowed their brothers and sisters, the ones that they were in community with, when they had fought to express their concern, to confront them. That's what leads me to believe that this was done lovingly. Their response to them, and then certainly the willingness of the other tribes to sacrifice their own land, their own possessions, their own inheritance to restore and make sure that their fellow Israelites were not caught up in sin, caught up in idolatry as they thought they might be or in rebellion against God. So we can learn from that, what they didn't say, how they didn't respond. They didn't attack back in defense. They didn't accuse. They didn't say, well, how dare you listen to that hearsay, that gossip? They listened. They allowed them to tell them their concerns, and then they responded. And I believe, again, the willingness to sacrifice on the part of the Western tribes opened the door for conversation. Again, if Phinehas and the other Israelites had simply attacked, even with their words, and not phrased it in such a way that it was a loving confrontation, which again I believe it was. Again, that's what I believe is borne out by the text. And their willingness to sacrifice, if that hadn't happened, if they had just attacked, the eastern tribes would have most likely gotten defensive and attacked in response. Instead, the eastern tribes were able to respond and converse with Phinehas and their fellow Israelites. They're able to appeal to them and tell them what actually happened. But initially, they first appeal to God because He knows for certain their hearts, and they believe that their brothers in the Western tribes have misunderstood what was happening there with the altar. Again, we already mentioned this threefold name of God that they use and repeat there in verse 22. They are appealing to the true God, and that is often what we have to do. Sometimes our only refuge when we are accused of something is the true God. He knows our hearts, and we must be satisfied with being right before Him, even if it means we are wrong in the eyes of some others. But thankfully, it didn't end there. It wasn't just them appealing to God. They ultimately were able to appeal to the fairness of Phinehas and these others show them that they were not doing what they thought they were perceived to be doing. They wanted to explain and clear up this misunderstanding, but they did so in a way, again, that wasn't confrontational, that wasn't attacking back, wasn't defensive in the sense of, hey, how dare you accuse me? How dare you even question me? They did it in a way where they even, in some sense, empathized with the ones who were confronting them. They said, if we were doing what you think we were doing, you had every right to come against us, to judge us, to bring the judgment of God upon us. If we saw what you saw, we probably would have done the same thing. That is the way they respond. So they explain their true reason for building the altar. It was built as a memorial, not a place of sacrifice. They go on to explain why they built this, because they didn't want future generations to see these tribes on the other side of the Jordan that are isolated and separated by the Jordan River and say, well, they're not part of us. They're not a part of our community. And they wanted to see that we do serve the same God. We serve the true God, God Yahweh. That was their intent. And their response was accepted by Phinehas and these other representatives. And they went back to the rest of the congregation, the rest of the western tribes, and they ultimately said, it's good. We got clarity and cleared up this misunderstanding. But it certainly could have gone a different way if not handled correctly, and how sometimes, unfortunately, we may the confrontations we may have been involved in when sin or parent sin is being confronted. So ultimately, everyone's glad and everyone enjoys the blessing of having peace among the people of God, having unity among the people of God. The altar is given the name Witness because it was a witness to the tribes on both the eastern side and the western side that the Lord is God, that Yahweh is God, and that they were unified in their service and worship and love for that one God. We've kind of brought out some, I hope you've, without even having to bring it out, just based on the emphasis of the text, based on just what is being conveyed here from the text, that there's application for this to us as community of Christ, as God's people here at Ella Grove. As an example of how we should respond to even apparent sin. First, we should respond with a concern for God's holiness. Again, sin within the Lord's church is personal. It can have a personal effect on us. And sometimes it's directly personal. It's a sin against us, as we see Jesus dealing with in Matthew 18. Whichever the case is, whether it's sin that's going to affect the body as a whole, public sin, like this obviously was public in the sense that people knew about it, people were talking about it, even though it turned out not to be sin or rebellion. Their concern was for God's holiness. And they were ready to go to war. They were ready to fight for God's glory, for His holiness. But then they also had the courage to respond in love, to confront in love, not just to go to war, not just to attack, but then to go to them personally and confront this apparent sin. They attempted to reconcile before it got to the point of open fighting, open war. And then again, I think this is the key to the text. Determine that you are willing to sacrifice to help them. Don't confront sin unless you are willing to help that person deal with that sin. Certainly we see empathy here. We brought that out from both sides. Determine that you will see the situation from the perspective of the other person. The Eastern tribe said, if we had seen it the same way you did, if we had misunderstood it the way you did, we probably would have responded the same way. We would have responded the same way. And then ultimately, the Western tribe said, we understand what you did. We see why you built this altar of memorial. And then lastly, determine that you will believe the best of one another. That is a real challenge, I think, just because of our human nature. It's one of the things that Paul brings out in 1 Corinthians, that love believes all things. And the application there seems to be of believing the best in one another. Not sugarcoating, not overlooking, not disregarding sin, because that's certainly not what happens here. We can certainly say they didn't just say, oh, well, let them go. They want to build their own altar. Lord, deal with that. That's not the attitude to have. If we love one another, we've served and fought side by side spiritually, then we're going to want to make sure if there's sin that needs to be dealt with. But then ultimately, when we have that confrontation, that loving confrontation, and we get an explanation, whether it be that sin was misunderstood or whether it was legitimate, believe the best of one another. Believe that what the person tells you is true. Don't read into their motives. Don't accept it and desire unity. May the Lord help us as New Covenant believers to learn from this Old Covenant lesson on how to deal with sin among God's people and restore unity within the community of Christ Church. Brother Matt, if you'll lead us in our prayer of thanksgiving.